Session number 17772.
Roy Hamlin, reel three.
Judging the water in that sense, when the water start, the tide receded back, then you put the vehicle nose into the water and away you went, following the flail tanks, which of course was a wonderful security for us, although obviously a flailing tank couldn't detonate every mine that could be there. You would rest assured that the majority of them would have been exploded, and providing a passage for you to drive through.
So, your job on D-Day was to drive a vehicle ashore.
That's right.
What kind of vehicle?
Foden, a 10-tonner.
What was the crossing like? The channel crossing?
All the boys were seasick, all but one. I wasn't seasick, yeah. Our sergeant was quite green. He said, "For God's sake, let's get off this boat." He said, "Doesn't matter what's happening over there, let's get off the bloody thing." And that was it. That nearly everyone was seasick. It was a very, very rough crossing.
And yours was a 10-ton vehicle.
Yeah, it was a mixture. See, that happened to be, but the Bedford 3-tonner was there, the ducks coming along by the side. I think one of the chief worries as we were waiting for our turn to get off was a mine had broken loose, and that was a vicious looking piece of material that. He was bobbing about loose on the sea, and it wasn't a terrific distance from us. And I remember thinking to myself, I'd never seen such a vicious looking thing in my life, but there it was with the prongs sticking up. And I don't know what happened to it. It must have been harnessed in. Someone must have got cracking on it because it was obvious they were bobbing around, but it was a little bit too close for comfort. And I don't know where it had broken loose from or whose it was, but it was definitely there. And of course, the big thing was that if you're trying to take everything in, was the enormous noise that was going on, because a battleship was behind us. I couldn't tell you exactly. I believe it was a British, but it was certainly belching out with every gun that it had right behind us. And so the whole thing was a thing of noise. I'm not going to say confusion. You could say that in one sense. I mean, anything of battle is a confusion. It's bound to be. But yet, it was still orderly that you knew exactly what you had to do. In other words, the training that you had received. When people ask me about this, I tell them exactly, what's your service life? I'll say, I'll tell you exactly. 2 years was solid training, where I learned to hate and to kill. It's simple as that.
Who taught you to hate?
This is my thoughts. When people ask me of my service life, I say, I'll put it to you simply. At the first 2 years was solid training. And on that D-Day morning, we had to put it into use. So for the next 12 months of my service life, was through to Germany, putting that into use.
What did you have in the lorry? What were you carrying?
It would be bullet shells, mixture. They were all necessary. Shells for the gun, for the tanks, bullets for the infantry. Later on, we became a little bit more of a mixture came along, and I remember this, that the flat-bottomed airships that they used, we were getting behind. The weather was so bad at times, we were getting a bit behind, and the flat-bottom ones, they actually took the risk of beaching them. And they were a target, weren't they? But you must remember that no German aircraft was seen during the daytime. It was all Allied aircraft. But during the night, there was no Allied aircraft whatsoever. Then it was German. So the fact that they were there, plunked on the sand, the flat-bottom boats, wasn't such a risk as it seemed. But I remember coming alongside there, and I thought to myself, another load going up, and all of a sudden, bung. I thought, what the devil is that? Something really heavy had gone aboard. And then another second bang. And when I looked, there was 2,000-pound bombs. It was in the back of the lorry. An airstrip had been temporarily made inland where wire mesh netting had been put on the runways so that the plane could land. And we took those bombs along. They were put on the planes. And the planes were taxiing off to deliver their bombs while we were still turning around. So quick as that.
When was this?
Oh, sometime after, maybe 10 days after D-Day. Yeah. But they had prepared a flat level pit with the wire mesh netting, see, so the planes could land on it.
Can you tell me the story about the 2,000-pound bombs again? Like, what exactly happened?
Well, because I had no inkling. See, I mean, we've been so used to carrying shells and that sort of ammunition that we certainly didn't anticipate something like that coming on board. And it was pretty frightening, isn't it? You got 2,000-pound bombs actually on the back of your vehicle.
They were dropped?
No, from the ship. They were part of the equipment. Instead of shells and bullets and that coming over, it was 2,000-pound bombs that had been carried over, and then we had to take up to the airstrip.
You had to deliver them.
Yeah.
Going back to D-Day,
yeah,
was the actual landing on the beaches as you expected or not?
Well, I suppose we didn't know what to expect. I certainly thought there would have been more resistance. This is only with hindsight, not what I thought at the time. The only thing that we thought about at the time was that you had a load of ammunition in the back and it had to be taken to X spot, which we had mapped out in front of us. Of course, and there again is another story, because we found our way along this road. We had a map and we knew that it was a cornfield, and when we arrived to it, being a country boy, I was a little bit shocked to think that what we were going to do to that cornfield, because there the corn, it was good. It was a splendid field. The corn was green and it had reached height of, say, 2'6" or whatever. And through we had to go, and the French farmer came on the scene, and the language, I couldn't speak French, but I could understand exactly what his language was, because we had to destroy his cornfield. And he became a very, very excited man, and I could rest assured that we were not very popular. That the last thing that he wanted was an Allied invasion of his part of France. But unfortunately, we had to destroy that lovely field of corn, because it was a munition dump earmarked, and fair enough, that was it.
What happened next?
Well, the poor farmer, he had just to accept that. There was nothing he could do. We could always leave an NCO or somewhat to deal with, or military police rather, to deal with that. I mean, that was what they were there for, to deal with problems like that. And I don't know, we had to turn the vehicle around, because all we knew was that we had to get back to the beach. it was a four-sided square, the route that we had to take us to keep. It was the beginning of one-way traffic, a four-sided square, and that is how we had to keep the munition dump up that corner, across here, down, back to the beach. And we did that for 3 days. And the only sleep that I remember taking was perhaps half an hour or so in the cab, at night especially. But if I can think of that now, when I think back at it, I think that we worked for 3 solid days and nights without virtually any stopping at all, except for the odd few minutes that you would need. Food, I don't know. I don't know. We just accepted iron rations or whatever it is that we had. But it was a very hectic 3 days and three nights that we worked solidly.
And it was then that you were told to pick up these bodies?
No, that was in the beginning. That was at the end of the day. There was a lull. Sometimes there would be a lull before the ships coming into position to be able to accommodate you. So instead of you just standing about doing nothing, you were told. I mean, one of the first orders I had, pick bodies up from the beach. That was an order. And you were there to do whatever had to be done. The beach master was in his house. He had his mastiff with him. And the orders came out fast and thick. He kept things moving. Of naval, he was a very, very efficient beach master. But he had to keep things moving and avoid the beach at all times from being cluttered up.
And were these bodies Allied troops or
Allied,
German troops?
Allied, or not both? German. Not German. I don't remember seeing German apart from these others that we picked up. I can't remember any German. I think the German probably, what happened there was that the force that was coming in at them perhaps made them retreat back to a more favourable position. Back. That's only what I assume. I think that anybody who were connected in any way with any action like this would tell you that it's confusion. You don't really know exactly what a position is, but as long as you obey whatever the orders are, you assume that the officers and senior NCOs know exactly what is going on. You simply obey and get on with the job. It's the first thing that I ever knew of what the situation that we were in. I had no idea. No one had any idea. And it was going along to the American sector. The American newspapers had arrived. What an advance of ours. And there was a map. And I think that perhaps that, looking at that map, was more frightening than the actual going in of the landing. Because when I saw what a pitiful little small area that we occupied, because I grandly imagined that, you know, the invasion had spread and that we were all the way along going in. But of course later on it made you realise that it took us 6 weeks to reach Caen.
When you picked these bodies up,
yeah,
where did you deliver them to?
To the burial party.
Where were they?
They're with us around, you know, doing their work around the beach. Like a pioneer corps would be, you know, you get the ordnance, you get all your units all working. See, our work was primarily to see to the unloading the ships and getting the ammunition in. It's no good a frontline soldier being there and he puts his hand back for ammunition and there's none there.
Did you have to remove any property from the bodies?
We didn't know the burial parties.
Yeah. Did you handle the bodies with respect?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, yes. It sort of drew home partly the horrors of what you were involved in. It's not a pretty sight, is it? I mean, there were several instances later on of that you felt the fear go right into you, the feeling. None more so, I think, than we went through Caen on the morning that it was liberated, if you like to call it that. We didn't call it liberated. The place was smashed up. I remember by the railway station, I remember the engines themselves lying on their side, one on its nose, up in the air. But it was after that that the real fear of warfare, I think, came into most of us in the unit. And that was the two battles that the Canadians were involved in with the Polish First Armour, Chatagais and Totalais, which was the actual advance to Falaise and closing that gap. It wasn't a trap. I mean, everybody knew exactly what it was. The Americans to come around and for the Canadian British to come, close the gap, and the German army, the Normandy army, that is, trapped. And of course, there was an army fighting for its life. And whatever we say of Germany, the German is a good soldier, the same as he has the utmost respect for the British Tommy. So we have the utmost respect for the German soldier. And he was fighting for his life to get out of that trap. And it was this, the desolation of that struggle to close that gap was terrifying. There you did see the bodies. There you did see the effect of destruction, the material of destruction. Cattle, horses, killed in the fields. And the whole place stinking, the stench of war. And then we reached Falaise, and there again was a terrifying sight because it was by full moon and the whole place had been shattered, destroyed. All you could see were the remnants of walls, everything destroyed. Everything was absolute destruction. It was then that we realised really what war was all about. But it was simply because an army was fighting for its very existence to get out. And of course it was unfortunate for us. Later on, in the Market Garden exercise in Holland, that some of the main units did escape out through that gap.
Can I just go back to these German bodies that you picked up?
Yeah.
Apart from the throats being cut,
yeah.
Did they have any other wounds on them?
No. No, they were simply workers. They weren't fighters. Possibly they didn't have any arms.
How did you know they were workers and not fighters?
Because of identification from the burial parties. They told us that their papers said that they were either Romanians or Yugoslavians or whatever. They were forced labour. But if they hadn't opted for that work and being part of the German army, then they would have had a worse fate wherever they were.
And whereabouts were they found, these bodies? Where did you find them?
Behind bunkers. behind fortifications. See, the German wall, sorry, the Atlantic wall, as you know, was Rommel's task to build those fortifications all the way along. And he was certainly doing a good job. He hadn't completely finished the job, but he was certainly doing a good job. And the fortifications were all there, so that they were in the bunkers or whatever.
And you say there were about half a dozen of them?
About half a dozen, yeah.
And did you feel it was the Free French who'd done it?
Nothing had any impact, not at that time. The task in hand.
Not the Free French, the French Canadians, you said?
Yeah. Well, I think it was later that you learnt these sort of things, that they said we avenged Dieppe and et cetera, et cetera. But that didn't really have any impact like that on us, you know. This thing was more perhaps terrible to us after, with hindsight, rather than at the time, because it couldn't have any impact at the time. It was a war. You were fighting for your own life, never mind about thinking about anyone else like that.
Was this the only incident of this kind that you came across?
Yes, oh yes, yeah. And it's certainly not an incident that I would want to enlarge on, because it's a different quality of thing. I mean, we didn't have any urge to do this, although when you think back at Coventry, you think back at Plymouth, you think back at all places, but no, it didn't have the impact like that. We were in a position and you simply got on with the job that you were trained to do.
Now, I think you'd like to go back to some things that you've missed out about.
Yes,
D-Day.
Yeah. So when we had finished all our initial training and that, and when we were starting to move towards the concentration area, I was part of an advance party. And we set up where the camp was going to be for the unit to be held, but there was no accommodation available at that time, and the only place that we could find to sleep was off a farmyard and was on a haystack. So we spent our night sleeping on the haystack, which was fine when we went to bed when darkness came, but it was the next morning that we found that it was not the ideal spot at all. During the night, of course, you could hear scuffling going on all around you. The animals were very busy, but the dew was so heavy that we were absolutely saturated the next morning when we got up. So it wasn't such a comfortable night's sleep at all. Now, when the unit finally arrived, we showed them where they had to pick up the tents, where they had to go. And then we found ourselves as part of an inspection. Weren't told too much knowledge about this, but anyway, the Canadian 3rd Infantry Division, of which of course we were part of, were lined up on three sides of this enormous great field, and I believe the farm was called Highfield. I may be wrong, but I believe that was the name of it. We were drawn up on three sides, and then lo and behold, the great generals of the time, and then King George VI came along. I was so shocked to see him, because he looked obviously a very sick man, and obviously he had been, made to look a little bit better than what he really was, makeup or whatever it is they use. He was evidently a very sick man. He didn't look left or right. He just went through the motions of passing right through us. But that was the inspection of King George VI. And the leading generals, of course the Canadian especially, of the time. And then we were still doing a final initial training to test the waterproofing, and we did this at the East and West Witterings along the Sussex coast, on from Southsea. And I suppose the most interesting memory of that would be one of the boys was a bit dim, but he was so enthusiastic that he realised that his vehicle could go into water, and he thought he would try to get out to France right away. In fact, he was going on and on with everyone yelling after him, and of course that vehicle was drowned because he was going right out into the sea. But
was he drowned?
No, the vehicle drowned. The vehicle. No, he wasn't. He was all right. He had to be towed out, of course. But he got too enthusiastic. In other words, he thought the vehicle being waterproofed, he could carry right on. Anyway, then back we come into the concentration area. I had to join in with the lads with the Crown and Anchor. That's all they played all day. Fortunes went forward and back. Not ours, because we were getting 10 shillings a day. 10 shillings a week. 10 shillings a week. So, and this was on Southampton Common. Our letters were very interesting there because they were printed on a green form. And you crossed out any messages that you didn't want and left in whatever message you wanted to send. And that was our letters home. And I wish that Mother had kept them, because it would have been a very interesting souvenir. But unfortunately, she didn't. But that was our letters home. They were already printed out for us. And now we started off. And of course, the first attempt was aborted because of the rough weather. Remember, we went, that was on June the 5th. And so we had to come back again. And it was here that a very cheerful and humorous and interesting remark was made as the Canadians and Americans looked. They said the goddamn limeys are invading their own country. We're going to invade England instead of where we're supposed to be going. But the weather was so bad that we had to come back. And that was the remark from the Canadians and the Americans. I've already mentioned that nearly everybody was very seasick by the journey over. Now, the unit was absolutely split because we were part of the Canadian 3rd Infantry Division, so there was an advance party which was concerned with the D-Day. There was the main party, which would be D plus one, and a quarter, which would be D plus two. And that's how the unit came in, because we were working in conjunction then with 101, who was on the other sector of SWORD. But the two units were intermingled.
That's 101 Company RASC.
RASC, yeah. Yeah. And the remarkable thing about this was that you get contradicted sometimes. You may have been oddly talking about this later on somewhere, and one of the lads would interrupt you and say, didn't land on the...